You are listening to Mountain to Glen, the podcast.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Mountain to Glen, the podcast. I'm your host, Robert Farrelly. And first of all, I would just like to wish everyone a Happy New Year, and I hope everyone had a wonderful Christmas. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get an episode out for December. Let's just say life got in the way a bit. But we're back now with the first episode for the new year. And before we get going on that episode, I've had a request to give a shout out to two hillwalkers, Dara and Amanda, who after coming down after her favourite walk on Cumshin Gaun, Dara popped the question to Amanda, and she said yes. So congratulations to the two of you, and what better way to get things going for the new year than a proper outdoor proposal. And on behalf of everyone here in Mountain to Glen, we wish you every happiness for the future. Okay, so now it's time to get on with the first episode of 2024. I hope you enjoy it. Welcome to this episode. I'm joined this evening by Sean Lundy and his friend Tom. And Sean himself is from Kilcool, County Wicklow. He's 20 and is studying health and performance science in University College Dublin. He is a dedicated cyclist who loves long rides and travel, but recently has been enjoying competing, racing on the road and XC mountain biking. He is an all-round bike nerd and works in Fat Bike Adventures and Little Big Bikes. He's also a sailing instructor during the summer months. He met his friend Tom when they were 14 years of age, a life-saving club, and found that they both loved mountain biking and have been best friends ever since. Guys, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having us. Great to be here.
We look forward to reliving our experiences through the podcast. Yeah, a nice jog of the memory.
Yeah,
for sure.
And what we're actually here to talk about this evening is just a little cycle you guys did from Norway to Italy last year. So first of all, I mean, obviously, the first question I always ask my guests is, what inspired you guys to do this? Why Norway to Italy, and what got you going on it?
So, it's an interesting question, and like, it's kind of hard to pinpoint one thing, I would say, that gave us the inspiration. We've always been like interested in cycling adventures, and it kind of, I guess, it was a sort of a natural progression, you know, like you do cycling and then you'd stay out for a little bit longer, then you'd get into camping, then you'd kind of combine the two. And then eventually we just got to the point where, I guess, our thirst for adventure came to a point where we wanted to do something a little bit longer. So we actually, in preparation for the big tour, we weren't completely sure what the big tour would be. After we finished secondary school, John and I just knew that we kind of wanted to do something big and make the most of our time. So we started by doing a practice tour to the Fossil HQ in Bangor in Northern Ireland. So that was basically just Sean and I strapped all the things we'd need, or we thought we'd need. We weren't completely sure at the time. You kind of always bring more than you think you need. So it's a good lesson. We put all the stuff on the bikes, and then it was about a 500 kilometer entire trip up to it's actually a bike sponsor of mine, Fossil Bikes in Northern Ireland. So we cycled up to them over a couple of days and then back just to test everything out. And that sort of gave us the inspiration and also the confidence to sort of think, well, you know, if we can do 5 days, we might be capable for a couple of months.
Yeah, Tom and I, we already started cycling, and then any sort of challenges or anything we've set ourselves, like, you think that cycling, like, our cycle didn't seem so impressive compared to a lot of other people. Like, to some it might be a huge journey, but to others it's not so much.
It's a good point that Sean makes. Like, cycle touring in general, it sounds like such a crazy concept to a lot of people. When you tell someone, you know, you've cycled from Norway to Italy, most people are mind blown by something like that. But actually, I think what we think is, it's probably not the hardest thing. It's not even the hardest cycle we've done. It's just, yeah, just kind of a thing where you're consistently just riding your bike and enjoying yourself. And it's not, we don't want to undermine the experience now, but it's not as difficult and not as daunting of a thing to get into as some people might think. You kind of just do as much as you can every day. And luckily, Sean and I would be quite good at communicating with each other, like how much would be able for that day, or if we wanted to take a rest. And, you know, it's kind of a very natural process and doesn't have to be as daunting as it seems. You kind of just break it up. Yeah.
Yeah, we've done big rides before, and I think we wanted to do something, like, we didn't want to push ourselves with a big trip, so bike touring was a good way of merging holidays and touring as well. Yeah. And the cycling, yeah.
Preparing for that cycle up north, was that really the time when you kind of figured out all the gear you would need for any journey like that? And was that, I suppose, the prep for the main trip itself?
Definitely, yeah. We've used like bike packing gear in the past, but never for, like, we've done overnighters and things, but going away for 2.5 months, you need a bit more stuff. So we tried to pack for that trip as if we were going away for 2 months. It wasn't that, oh, you can get by with this many clothes or this much gear for however long the test trip was. I think it was about 4 or 5 days. So we packed as if we were going to do the full thing, and that was a really useful trip to decide what we needed to bring.
Yeah, the bikes were definitely heavier than they needed to be, but it was a good test to see what we'd have to deal with on the real thing. And I think something like that sort of a practice tour is really helpful for anything. Like when you undertake or when you set yourself a big goal like that, it's a good idea to do a bit of preparation. Not only for like the logistical side, to know how much gear you have to bring, but even the social side of it. You know, like at the end of the day, you're like, bike touring does get difficult at times. And if you're deciding to do it with a mate and you haven't, you know, you haven't been close quarters, you know, in a tent after you've been sweating all day, and then it's piss bucketing down rain, and you realize, well, you know, the other person's a little bit smelly, or you are yourself. And that's something like you may not actually think about before you go on a tour like that. But just to kind of have things in place as well for if it does happen that you come and have an argument, because, like, you know, we're only human at the end of the day as well. Luckily, actually, didn't end up happening. Sean and I are just good enough mates, and I think we know each other well enough now, having been friends for so long, that it didn't end up happening that we had any major falling out. But it was, I wouldn't take all the credit for the for thinking of doing a practice tour. A lot of that actually was our parents as well, and they suggest, you know, it might be a good idea just to get the practice in, and it definitely helps for something like that.
I think the practice tour might have also, there was some bits that lured us into a false sense of security, and that we got this, like, we had it really good for, like, weather wise. There was tailwind every day. The route was lovely. And we actually did like a much higher average speed than we were expecting. And then when we went back to planning the bigger trip, we found out that when we started going, that we were cycling much, much slower than we were when we cycled in Ireland, so Northern Ireland. I don't know if it was a pacing thing, but I think a good tailwind had something to do with it. Yeah, and that was something that was different when we took it on the bigger trip than when we were cycling here in Ireland. Yeah.
And just getting used to traffic and whatnot. And there's always like, I think the route was fairly straightforward going to Northern Ireland. Like, it wasn't the most scenic, but it was,
yeah,
it was kind of straight there.
Like, we'd know half the route up already, so it wasn't too far from home. But definitely a good trip to do as a transition from more of the bikepacking weekend sort of stuff to the longer multi-day trips. Yeah,
for sure.
Sound advice, take that trip in first. But as you say, the weather was spied just a little too much on that one.
I will say, like, they're probably planning the bigger trip. Like, there wasn't really much doubt that we weren't able to do it. It was more just to get the gear sorted. We're more worried about whether we'd have anything. But we found out that, like, we weren't too far away from home in Europe, that you can also, there's a shop around every corner, so even if you do lose a vital piece of gear, it's you can get that back with a bit of money spending, and it'll get you out of a higher place. So it is not the end of the world if you do leave your house and buy stuff as you go along, bit of credit card touring. Yeah,
that's like touring is such a lofty idea, I guess, and you can kind of do it whatever way you want. But going back to what Sean said, like, I think it was helpful how we started the route. I don't think it was something we sort of planned, how easy it was going to be in the Scandinavian countries to actually get along. Like, we're lucky that, I guess, living in Europe, you basically have all the services there, and you're rarely left in a situation like, I don't know, I'd be following people now cycling across Africa and continents like that. It's a completely different story. So a European tour in the sense of infrastructure and just having shops and stuff available, you're rarely going to be going 3 or 4 days without food and water, you know, that sort of thing. So that definitely made it easier for us and kind of took away a bit of the stress in the first few weeks. And then also, I think this is going to come up a lot, the camping. So we spent a lot of time wild camping. Most of that was actually by necessity, even though we enjoy it. Because of the time of year that we did it, most campsites, as we found out, kind of close September, end of September. So having gone from September to November, we found out that wild camping was sort of a thing we'd have to do. But in the Scandinavian countries, the wild camping is incredible.
Yeah, camping is one thing that we've both done it for a while, even before we even started cycling. So there wasn't any learning curve for that. But it definitely was part of the inspiration that, like, none of us had stayed in a tent for more than 10 days straight before the trip. So I would say that Tom is more of the camper than I am. I have nothing wrong with staying in a tent, and I love saving money, but
I'd probably live in a tent if I could.
To get to places rather than going out in the woods and enjoying that. Yeah, so Tom definitely loves his camping more than I do.
I think I would say, without over-exaggerating, that I got some of the best sleep of my entire life on that trip because of the whole camping thing and sleeping outside. It's just pretty good. Like, the first few nights are a little bit rocky, but once you get into it, it's beautiful. And we were lucky in the sense that Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, the first three countries that we were in, all have like an excellent shelter system. So essentially the first few days we were literally just plotting our route using an app called Komoot, and you could just go from one shelter to the next. Now, mind you, the shelters are fairly rudimentary. It's kind of usually just a wooden lean-to. Sometimes they have a fire pit, but they're in really scenic places. Sometimes I think it's a volunteer thing where locals will put like firewood there for you to take and use freely, which is just an amazing resource. And it definitely made the first couple of weeks of the trip easier to get into, because I think if we'd been confronted with, you know, wild camping in places in Italy, for example, that's not something you can kind of predict beforehand. Maybe you'll know that there's shelters in certain places, but some countries are definitely more difficult than others in terms of that. And I would say we got a little bit lucky.
Yeah, I think we did the right way in planning the route, but can be quite different to Irish camp ratio and where you camp. So you have to kind of figure it out for each country. So touring in Ireland, if you go to a country like Tom mentioned in Scandinavia where they have huts, it's easier to camp. But somewhere else, you might find it much harder. Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, the infrastructure and the rules change per country as you go along.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's actually something we'd be consistently checking. Like, we'd come into a new country and we'd have to like check up on the laws because they can change. Kind of have to be careful.
But not that put us off in a lot of the places, but luckily we had no one bothering us.
It's more about the attitude, I think. Yeah. If you leave no trace, and you know, naturally you're sort of pitching your tent when it gets dark and leaving when it gets bright. So most of the time you wouldn't even see anyone, but I don't think we ever had an experience where it became an issue. We were kind of just sensible about it. And you kind of, if someone comes past in the morning, you wave at them and you might have a chat with them if you're not too groggy after a night's sleep. But yeah, it didn't really seem to be an issue for us. And I don't think, I haven't heard that it's major difficulty for many people.
Just on the gear you brought for the trip, the clothing to tent to carrying the gear? First of all, on the clothing, how much clothing did you actually bring? You don't want to bring too much because you don't want to be laden down with that either.
Yeah, we did have to be quite wary with that because obviously we knew, so we did this in autumn. We started in September and then we knew we'd be finishing somewhere around early December or late November. Obviously, we were going south and that was kind of planned into our route that it would be getting warmer as we were going down. And yeah, there was, we were either going to start in Sweden or start in Norway. And we chose Norway mainly just to get another country ticked off. But we weren't too sure what the weather conditions were going to be like up in Norway. But luckily, we were okay. Yeah, we had quite a range of temperatures. We crossed through the Austrian Alps. Yeah, it was below freezing most of the nights. So that was consideration when picking clothing to bring. I was quite surprised about how little you can get away with clothing-wise.
One thing I would say is that actually it hugely depends on the person. Sean and I would have very different senses of what cold and warm is. So Sean, like, we'd be in the Alps and it would be like 0 degrees in the morning and Sean would be there in his, had like his baggy short sleeve jersey that he'd be wearing and I'd have like all my clothes on and be freezing. So
yeah, I think it is different, but yeah, I don't know how many like t-shirts we didn't wear cycling gear. We just wear normal outdoor clothes, which I think is, if you're not going a certain speed, like we weren't getting too sweaty or anything like that, so you can get away with outdoor clothes. I started off with more and then I sent some clothes home halfway through because I realized I didn't need that much. And I mean, it's nicer to get some weight off the bike, and if you're not going to use it, then don't have to wash it or anything like that. So I had probably, it was about 3 t-shirts and then 2 jumpers, and then I'd swap between one pair of shorts and one pair of trousers. I think the most useful thing that I learned was to wear merino base layers in bed. So when you cycle all day, you're feeling kind of dirty in your clothes. You just get in, when you get to your campsite, you can get into your merino base layers and then it'll feel like a fresh set of clothes. So as long as you're changing your clothes, it always feels like there's something fresh rather than getting into the same thing day after day.
Merino is definitely wonderful. Like, it does as much as it can. Like, at a certain point, it'll smell, but much lighter than other fabrics would, I think. It kind of keeps you warm when it's cold and cold when it's warm. Like, it really is class, and then great for sleeping in. So I kind of did pretty similar to Sean that I'd have. I think I usually wore a certain merino top for sleeping and then another merino top throughout the day. And then we'd usually wash, like, we'd aim to wash once a week. So, you know, kind of pushing it a little bit, but like that's something that kind of takes up a lot of time, all these little things. So you kind of try to push them out. Same with charging, actually, as well. So like that's the way it kind of just worked out, is that we'd be wild camping probably 6 nights a week. And then let's say on the 7th day, we'd get a hostel or go to a campsite and make sure that we could charge our power banks and all our devices, and then wash our clothes and maybe get a nice warm shower as well, which is definitely underrated, as you come to realize when you've been sweating all week.
Your swim togs can also act as another pair of shorts. If you're looking to cut down on your clothing, definitely don't go overboard on bringing too many shorts, because it's just not required.
Don't expect to win any prizes for fashion when you're walking through the campsite in your shorts, like the vest that you got like 15 years ago or something like that, you know. You'd be
standards change dramatically. Absolutely. I think it would be acceptable.
I think it helped that nobody there knew us. Sometimes we'd be walking through the campsites with like you know, our long johns on and some hat that we'd found, and like, do you remember I lost a pair of gloves, or one of my sets of gloves? So I had 2 mismatched gloves. I found, like, I had my right-handed glove and then I lost my left-handed glove. So I found a glove on the ground, but it was actually turned out to be our right-handed glove as well. So I wore it. It
was slightly colder.
Yeah, it looked a bit silly, but you know, it did the job and it wasn't wasteful. So we got by with that.
For the colorful characters in the campsite.
Yeah.
I wonder if we scared a couple of people. By the
way. Maybe that's why they told us all the campsites were closed. They didn't want to.
Yeah, they took one look at us and turned us the other way. Yeah. In fairness, we were like usually the only people at the campsites anyway, because people don't tend to, interestingly enough, camp in September, October, November, that sort of time. So we usually had the place for ourselves in the beginning, yeah.
And what size tent did you just bring?
We had a two-man tent. It was an MSR tent and the Elixir ones. So we'd split that up between us. I would say a lot of people, if you're touring with two people, they like to have two separate tents. But I think with the Elixir, it's got two different porches. So either side, which is really nice because you don't have to climb over whoever you're staying with to get out. And also, you just have space to organize your own thing. So it is quite doable with one tent. And obviously, it does save quite a lot of room. We'd split it up between us. Yeah.
And what I'd say is what we figured out like pretty early on is that it's better to sleep head to toe. So Sean would sleep one way, I'd sleep the other way because the mats tend to be a little bit wider on one side. And it's just you kind of have a little bit more of your own space. The only thing is that I definitely like to have my head pointing upward. So like you don't have the luxury of having a flat spot whenever you go wild camping. And Sean will sleep on a 15 degree incline, like with the blood going to his head. He won't even notice. I couldn't do that.
Yeah.
That's where my sleep is a little bit more important to me.
We also have very different bedtimes. So I think, yeah, maybe two tents would help us, but yeah, I like to sleep a lot earlier and wake up earlier. But obviously, we come to a compromise about what time we'd leave in the morning. And yeah, it has to be done.
Wouldn't say it was a bad thing either for me. It actually, like, doing basically Sean's routine, more or less, I think I maybe adjusted a little bit. But it definitely gave me a better discipline. And actually, I came to realize that it probably was better to get going early in the morning. Whereas if I was by myself, I think the tour would have taken me a bit longer because I do like to sleep in
regularly.
And it's harder for me to get out of bed in the morning than he'd be packed up and having his breakfast and I'd barely be getting out of my sleeping bag. But it's just the way it goes.
At the time of year, it was a bit of a, I think we could have gotten a lot more. Our distance was really dictated each day about when it got dark as well. And obviously it was coming into winter time. So we could have cycled much longer days if it were for the fact that the days didn't get dark earlier and we didn't cycle much in the dark. We tried to avoid that.
Yeah, so it definitely helped that Sean was kind of keeping me in line, because I think if we'd gotten up at, or like if it were up to me, we probably would have left at 11 or 12 each day and then barely gotten any cycling in. So Sean definitely helped me with that. And towards the, probably the first few days, it took a little bit of adjustment period for me. But I was thankful for it by the end, because you get more cycling in, you know. You're less stressed than I think throughout the day. If you leave at an early enough time, you leave yourself enough time to do whatever. And also, if something does come up that you haven't planned for, like, I don't know, the washing machine breaks or something, and whatever, something takes a little bit longer, or you have a mechanical on the bike, then at least you're not in the middle of nowhere without really an idea of where you're gonna set up camp. So the earlier you leave, you're giving yourself a little bit of a safety line, I guess, for that. Yeah,
and your routine is like the camping, like together with the tent, like we could set it up and take it down in less than 2 minutes without even talking to ourselves in between us at the end. So yeah, you do get into a good routine of doing the same thing every morning, and once you know everything has a place and where it goes in your setup, you can cut down that prep time in the morning very quickly, and you can go from being asleep to being on the bike much quicker.
Brilliant. And just with the gear you brought, did you use a trailer at the back of the bike, or do you have bags?
I'd say you'd describe our setup. We didn't have a trailer and it wasn't full. We didn't have any front panniers. They were more the cargo racks. So full pannier setup on the rear and a bag on top of the rack, and then two smaller, like the roll top dry bags on the forks. So a bit of a more lightweight setup than a round the world tour would have, but not a bike packing setup.
And I think so. We kind of settled on the having everything on the bikes, just because that was the bags available to us. but also on the Northern Ireland tour, we came through lots of little gates and stuff. And I've always wondered, like, what you would do if you came to, like, a gate and you had all your stuff on a trailer and you had to lift it over somehow. Because I guess I would say one of the major advantages of having everything on the bike is that the bike is still that size and it's more nimble. Especially, like, also if you're taking a bike on public transport and stuff, like, there were instances where we had to take the bike on buses and then, like, trains towards the end. I think it may be more difficult to figure that out with a trailer. The advantage of a trailer then probably being that it puts less strain on the bike. And then, like, let's say you do set up camp somewhere, you can just easily take off the trailer and ride off on your bike, and it's as normal. So it has pros and cons. We didn't really consider a trailer at any point. We just used what we had, but I think it worked well for us.
We thought we had loads of stuff with us, more than we're used to for our overnight trips here in Ireland. But yeah, a lot of the people we came across who are doing similar routes to us had a lot more gear on their bikes. And yeah, we actually met a group of rock climbers in Sweden who were cycling to Croatia, I think it was.
Yeah.
And they had, like, they had all their rope and all their protective gear with them, along with their camping gear as well. So we were definitely the ones going lightweight, even though we thought we had loads of stuff with us, yeah.
And Sean even more so than me, yes. Like, so Sean would be, even when it comes to bike touring, definitely more lightweight. I have a certain few luxuries that I can't really give up. I had my memory foam pillow from Decathlon.
He did convert me on the pillow, though.
The pillow is handy. Yeah. And then I had my chair. I think it's become a little bit of a famous chair.
Running joke, book. Yeah.
So I had, like, a little stool that I got off AliExpress, and I had it on the Northern Ireland tour. And people were always commenting on Instagram that I'd even brought a chair, and I kept it going for the final tour then, because it's just I couldn't give it up. I kind of got emotionally attached to it, and it's nice to be able to stretch out your legs then at the end of the day when you're cooking your dinner and stuff, and just have somewhere dry and a little bit off the ground to sit. It's nice, and you don't kind of get your legs just cramped up and whatnot. Yeah, it's nice to just be able to stretch them out. For me, it's a necessary luxury, or it was on that tour anyway.
Well, I won't fault you for that one, especially if you can have it there, like, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And just on the actual trip from Norway to Italy, did you have a specific route in mind, or were you kind of a bit more loose about what way you would travel down to Italy?
So we used, I don't know if you've heard of them, but they're the Eurovelo routes. So there's a collection of long-distance cycling routes across Europe. We have, I think there's two of them in Ireland. There's one which is Eurovelo 1, which goes from, I think there's bits in Scandinavia as well, but that goes, links up the Wild Atlantic Way and then goes down through France, Spain and Portugal. And I think there's about 20 of these routes in total.
Yeah, they kind of span throughout Europe. It's kind of I think the European countries have a sort of agreement that they put a certain amount of money into cycling infrastructure, and then they'll create routes or Eurovelo, the actual company, I think it's separate. They sort of match up the different bike lanes and stuff in different countries, or if different countries have put money into specific areas like the Wild Atlantic Way, it's sort of like an approved European network of bike trails and routes. That's a good way to get started, I think, on bike touring.
They'll take you off all the main road. Generally, I'd say for maybe 30% of it, there would be a cycle path or even a cycle road in some countries. But definitely a good way. If you're looking to start bike touring, it's the easy way in, and plenty of routes to take your pick from.
I would say just take that with a little bit of a grain of salt, though. Some countries are definitely smoother than others. Scandinavian countries, perfect. I don't think we came across a single hill, definitely not in Denmark, until we kind of got probably towards the end of Germany and Czech Republic. And then it definitely got a little bit rougher, like what I think the Czech Republic would consider an approved bike route would be very different to what the Norwegians would consider a good bike route. But it definitely adds to the adventure when you're on roads that, you know, kind of look like they came from the medieval times.
Back to bike setup on the terrain was very, as Tom said, it varied quite a lot. But you definitely need wider tires than a road bike if you're going to follow one of these Eurovelo routes. So I had 34 mil tires, which are a bit on the skinny side, I'd say. I was expecting it to be mostly paved or really fine gravel, but there was some sections. The routes are marked in some countries. They'll say if it's a developed section of the Eurovelo or an undeveloped section. And some of the sections in the Czech Republic and in Italy were quite rough, so you might not want to take a road bike on.
Yeah, there's definitely sections where it's just a comfort thing then at the end of the day as well. You could probably get by most of the time. You might have to walk certain sections, but at the end of the day, like, bike touring is supposed to be enjoyable as well. And if you're comfortable, it definitely, you know, helps the experience. Whereas opposed to if you're trying to go fast and you have really skinny tires, then, you know, your wrists will start hurting earlier and just every bump is a little bit more jarring and stuff. So definitely good idea to have slightly wider tires. I think I had 45s, which is to the other extreme.
Huge,
it's pretty big, but you don't really notice the fact that you're going slower, and just being more comfortable is just nice. Yeah.
So the route we took was Eurovelo 7, which is, well, somewhat, we didn't quite stick to it at the very start, but it's called the Sun Route, and it goes all the way from Finland down to Sicily.
So very, very long. It's called the Sun Route because it starts in the Northern Hemisphere, and then the idea, and actually it did turn out to be like that, was that it would get warmer. Or the weather would be better the more south you got, because I think by the end of our tour, so when we finished in Italy, it was already snowing and icy in Norway where we'd started in Oslo. So it was good. I think we timed it well, and it was advantageous. I think that was one of the major things that we considered about the route, is sort of like that we might start in somewhere that's a little bit colder and then go to a warmer area as winter comes. Because when you're cycling through Norway in December, it's probably not as nice of an experience, I would say.
It's fun until it starts to rain. You can deal with cold temperatures, but
Rain is the enemy, absolutely.
Yeah. No, I can appreciate that. And it's probably more of an encouragement for you as well as you continue to cycle south, that warmer climate as well. And how long in total the actual journey from Norway to Sweden take you? Norway to Italy.
Is it kilometer-wise or time-wise?
Time-wise. And actually kilometer-wise as well.
Yeah, so it was 66 days it took us. Now, we did take a significant break in Germany. We stayed with Tom's grandparents. So that was kind of a break halfway through. But 66 days in total. It was, unfortunately, a few kilometers short of 4,000 kilometers.
And I did slightly shorter journey. So the way we did it towards the end then was I went ahead. We finished in Rome officially. Sean did. I probably had about 400 kilometers less. So what I did was I took a train from Florence to Rome, finished my tour a little bit earlier, and then just met up with some friends there that I'd known from the past. Met up with them. Sean continued cycling, made it to Rome a couple of days later. And then because we'd booked our flights in advance, and then we both headed off together then from Genoa, wasn't it?
Yeah, we really didn't have any idea of how long it was going to take us when we started off. And like I said, with the Northern Ireland trip, our speed was a lot different than we thought it was. It was already a bit slower. We could do it faster if we pushed ourselves, but we weren't in it for that, really. Yeah, so we hadn't booked the return flights when we started out, but we found that, when we got to Italy and we did book the flights, it's a very different sort of holiday, whereas the way we did it by going and not knowing when we're going to come back is definitely the more enjoyable way to do it.
And a piece of advice that I would give people is to not structure the tour too strictly for yourself starting out, because you'll end up taking more time than you think you need, and you set yourself under pressure if you have your day planned out hour by hour. It's really hard to know what's going to happen, and it's much better if you kind of have a loose idea of where you want to go, maybe know how much you'd like to do per day. But I've heard from a lot of tours that like started out knowing exactly like, okay, so we're going to be here on the first day, here on the second day, here on the third day. They start out with intentions like that, and then it just becomes too much to manage. And it becomes easier to kind of just go with the flow, I would say.
And these were all things that we're worried about when we started off, like, where are we going to, do we have to know all the certain camp spots like along the whole route? But we found that we got into a routine of you'd wake up wherever you were in the morning and you'd see like, how are the legs feeling today? Or what's the weather like? And like, how far do I want to cycle? And then you go look at the map and find a suitable camp spot by looking out for a forest or somewhere where there's a river. And then you'd cycle it. If you don't get to it, like generally there's another perfectly good camp spot 10 minutes down the road that you can stop at. So yeah, it's works out to be quite flexible.
And you traveled through quite a few countries there. So what were your experiences like going through these countries and hitting the different cultures?
Well, it's amazing that we were able to get all the way from so high up north in Europe down all the way to south without having your passports checked once. It's quite a
yes.
quite a unique thing to do. So
yeah, the European Union, I guess you kind of just travel through. But yeah,
so they're all very different, but obviously they have the same. We all got through them with not much hassle at all, and quite easy going in that way. We'll say like going through a country on a bike, there's no way of not experiencing it properly. You know, sometimes you go away on a holiday somewhere and you come back and you're like, oh, have I really been to that country or did I get the full amount out of it? But when you're on a bike, you cycle through all the good bits, all the bad bits, the cities, the like outside in the wilds of nowhere. And with the Eurovelo routes, you're on very different roads to what most people are going on. So it's definitely a good way of seeing everything. Yeah.
And just to kind of go off that, so it's very hard to say like what your favorite would be. That, as Sean said, like there's good and bad to every country. I think in general, we had good experiences through the board, more than we thought we would. Like, you know, going into a tour like this, don't really know what to expect. You come to find that 99% of people are really nice. And I think the bike is a great way of actually coming to talk to people and interacting. You know, you just stop somewhere and fill up water and someone would see you there and maybe start talking to you and have a nice conversation with, you know, a Niels Andersen in Denmark or wherever in Italy, you'd have a conversation with someone in a pizza shop. Could be anything. So it really can't be said. Like, I would say, you know, the Scandinavian countries in general have really good infrastructure, and that's nice. As Sean mentioned, I stayed with my grandparents in Germany. I'm actually originally German. So it helped for me, I think, in Germany and in Austria and also in parts of northern Italy, that I was able to speak German with the people. It's I guess it's still the case if you speak to someone in their native language, you kind of get an even better sense of what the country is like. And it kind of it's a good way to disarm people, but you know, start a conversation. People like to be able to talk to you. But yeah, throughout the board, people were super friendly. Food in Italy, I think that's a stereotype, but the food in Italy was particularly good, in my opinion. The beer in Czech Republic, if you're ever on the hunt for cheap alcohol, it's a good place to go for that. Not that we did much of that because we're very conscious of our recovery on the tour. Austria has amazing roads and beautiful scenery. So really, I don't think we could fault any country in being particularly bad. And we did have some poor experiences, but I don't know if it's a reflection of the country or more so just being unlucky. I think we'll probably come to talk about some of the
low points,
but there was never anything too terrible.
Well, just on that then, since we've reached that, I mean, what were the low points for you on the trip?
Well, I think Sean might start with the, I've crammed the yogurt incident. I'll get on to the power bank incident after that.
Oh, this is the same day. So, yeah, there was one standout day. All our luck seemed to come against us in the Czech Republic. I'd already just recovered from got some real bad sickness for 2 days. And then as we were getting going again, we had just this day out of nowhere that seemed like it would never end. And it started off that we needed to charge up some power banks for our phones and for our Wahoos, our bike computers. So we went into this McDonald's, the first one we could find. We were looking for anywhere really that we could plug in. And we sat down and plugged in our power banks and at the table behind us. And then a few moments later, we turned around and the people at the table had changed and the power banks were gone.
Yeah. So, yeah, someone unfortunately had taken my power bank, which was a major kick in the teeth at the time. So essentially what the case was, I think there was only one or two ports at our table. So I think I plugged in my power bank at the table behind us. It was underneath the table. So to kind of see it, you'd have to go looking for it. And I think a school group came in and, yeah, I don't want to point fingers, but basically once the school group left, the power banks, I think, went with them. So that was definitely not a great start to the day. I would say not so much for the monetary value of the power banks. Like, it's just something, you know, the power bank can be replaced. But what's annoying about it is, like, I think we...
Like, that sets you back time-wise as well. Like, the power bank can keep you on cycling without having to stop anywhere for a week. So
The biggest annoyance of it is, like, that... charging your power banks and doing the washing, this is all stuff that you don't really want to have to do, and it's more so like a necessity to enjoy yourself, that you're able to, you know, go continue cycling. So when you've been sitting in a McDonald's for 2 hours charging your power bank, or thinking that you've been charging your power bank so that you continue cycling for the rest of the week, and then you find out that your power bank's gone and you have no way of charging your phone then, and you know you have to get a new power bank then or something, it's just it was quite annoying at the time, but, you know, I think I found a shop then in that same town and got it replaced, and it wasn't the end of the world. But that, at the time, I think it seemed like a bigger thing. I was pretty annoyed. And then, you know, it kind of gets put into perspective as what happened later on in the day was maybe a little bit more serious. But yeah, so it wasn't too bad at the end of the day.
So we leave and we think, oh, that morning, we'll get that over with and get to some cycling. And we're coming along. A lot of the cycle paths in the Czech Republic are wild. Like, they go through the forests and they're really up and down and like a roller coaster. And so we get to this one bit and it was a nice descent. And we're letting off the brakes and going pretty quick. And there's a lot of really narrow path. And probably going a bit too quick than we should have, but we're cyclists.
We did.
We like to do
it. Hindsight, yeah.
And we come around this corner, and there's another cyclist who's coming up the other way. So I could have slowed down slowly, and everything would be okay. But I grab a bit too much brake, and the bike slips from under me, and we slide down, and. Next thing I know, Tom is also sliding behind me on his bike along the greasy, leafy path. And we come to a stop right in front of
poor guy.
This guy who's just out for a Sunday ride is shocked to see these two people hurtling down the hill in front of him. Yeah, and luckily, no serious injuries, but I ripped my trousers.
A little bit of bruising, maybe a bruised ego, yeah.
Yeah, but so he cycled down and we're like, your man was shocked. And luckily he wasn't too annoyed at us because obviously we didn't crash into him, but we could have. And he goes on about his day and then left to sort out the mess, which is what I find when I look inside my pannier. And
oh, man.
So I go to open it up and then the yogurt pot is just everywhere. Like,
oh.
All over clothes and all tools and everything. And on top of that, my bike is also pretty beat up. Like, the disc rotor is very badly bent and a couple of other bits. So that was our lowest day, I'd say. But there's nothing you can do. I think the longer you do cycle your bike, the more likelihood that you're going to fall off is going to happen. It's inevitable. So if you drove your car every day, for the whole year, you're bound to crash at some point, I would think. So
yeah. It's not jinxing it.
It was just bad that we had those two two setbacks in the one day?
I would say I look back at it and I think we just got it all over with in one day, and then that was all our bad luck used up. So looking back, you know, we can laugh about it. And at the end of the day, like, neither of us got seriously injured or anything. It was an inconvenience at the time, but a spilt yogurt pot and a
ripped trousers
and a slightly bent disc rotor is all things we could fix,
I think,
pretty much there and then. And it kind of then we spent like the next 20 minutes trying to get Sean's disc rotor straight so that he could continue cycling. But things like that just kind of teach you, you know, to think a bit on your feet. You kind of just, you're in a bit of a crappy situation then. Luckily, you're with another person, so it kind of, you know, you can kind of help each other out in that sort of situation, and you kind of just figure it out and keep going then, you know.
A funny point, I think the panniers actually made the crash not so bad, because the bike sort of tipped, and then they're kind of like balloons that you're sliding on at the side rather than you and your bike on the ground. It's the panniers sliding around the ground, and they're tough, like, waterproof things, so they took it quite well.
The yogurt pot didn't, though.
No.
Yeah, no, not the yogurt pot.
Yeah. A day to forget, really. But, yeah, I think, like, when you look back on these things, it wasn't really so bad. And you only remember the good bits, too. You never remember all the horrible rainy days that you had or the bad weather.
Yeah.
Well, okay, that was your worst day on the trip. Do you have any particularly really good, memorable days then to counteract that?
Too many to count. I think the one that we regularly come back to is Lysekil, as Sean said, the day of the prawn sandwich and all the little ferry crossings and stuff. So to give you a bit of context, Lysekil is in Sweden. It's on the west coast. It's essentially like, it's not just Lysekil, but it's the entire area is it's like little islands, rocky islands dotted along the coast. And to get from point A to point B, there's lots of little ferry crossings. Most of them are free as well.
Yeah.
So we kind of just spent the entire day island hopping, like real tourists. And then I got my prawn sandwich. So I think, as I've mentioned, I'm big into the food. That's culinary aspect.
I'll just eat to fuel rather than...
Yeah, for me, the food is quite important. So I'd heard of the famous prawn sandwich in Sweden. I'm not actually sure what it's called in Swedish. Even if I did know, I probably wouldn't be able to pronounce it. But anyway, I knew I had to get my hands on one of these. So we got to a little harbor that was in Lysekil, wasn't
it?
So we got to this place called Lysekil. It's like a kind of a holiday village, I would say. I think it gets quite popular in the summer, but it was deserted at the time. And I saw that a place like opposite the water was like a restaurant, and they were advertising prawn sandwiches. So I was like, oh, I have to get my hands on one of these. So Sean stayed there and took a nap. He wasn't too interested. So I did another 10K of cycling or something and got my prawn sandwich, and it was great.
It was just one of the perfect days. Good weather, and I just love following a route that you don't know where it's going to go. And we just keep on going over all these islands, and it feels like it would never stop. But yeah, the weather has a big influence on it. I'm just happy on a bike anyway, so many good days.
And that's the thing as well, like, we would experience these things quite differently, I think. Like Sean, when we talk about, like, we regularly talk about the tour, it's kind of a game that we have. I just mention a day, like a memory from the tour, and then we kind of go back to, oh, what did we do that day?
Where did we camp at?
Usually it comes to, where did we camp? So Sean is like really good at remembering all the places that we cycled and like where we camped. He's got an incredible memory with that. And then I'd remember like the food and probably the people and stuff like that. So it's really nice in hindsight to be able to look back and then see how differently we experienced it and what we kind of... you know, what we focus on naturally, I guess. Yeah.
I could see that between the two, you just make a pretty good story, like, you know, between the food and the adventures and the days themselves. And I'm curious, like, having traveled all the way down from Norway to Italy, when you were coming into Italy, and I know you also ended your trip slightly earlier, so for both of you, when you realized you were coming to that part of the trip where you're nearing the end, what was it like for you in those moments?
Looking back at it now, I think there was wanting to go home as well. Like, it's the longest time I've spent away from home. But obviously, I knew as soon as I go home, I want to go back and be touring more, which I do. So it's different in that way. So you kind of trying to make it last longer, but also the goal is so close. We knew that we wanted to finish in Rome. And you've obviously been cycling down to Rome for 2 months. So there is that, the trying to get there, but also trying to enjoy every last bit. And it was different not having Tom for the last 3 days of the cycle and learn to camp on your own and do stuff on your own, which is quite difficult. Do manage fine, but it's quite different touring on your own. Yeah, so I was looking at getting home, but also thinking that, yeah, I won't have this luxury when I'm back at home. Yeah.
So I kind of had a different experience, but similar in a way as well. So actually, the end was a little bit anticlimactic. Like, when you've been cycling for such a long time, you kind of build an expectation of what you'll feel like at the end. And it always probably doesn't feel quite as good as you expected. But like, I wouldn't say it's a bad thing. The main thing I think about a journey like that is you kind of just enjoy it as it's happening, and you don't set yourself too many expectations for what it'll be like at the end. So like, realistically, my last day of cycling was kind of like 10K, and I ended at a train station somewhere. And I think I asked a few old ladies there to take a picture of me, and they had no idea why. They were just like, okay, yeah, we take picture, whatever. And then I explained to them, I think I tried to tell them like, oh, I've been on a long cycle tour, and they didn't really understand me. They were Italian, but they're very nice, in fairness. But then, so what I did was I took a train to Rome and met some friends there and kind of just let it sink in of what I just done. It's a very big thing, and it's not something you kind of can process in the space of a day. I think we're still like learning things from the tour and remembering certain things. So yeah, I would say like the final day is probably not going to be like the best day of it either, or it wasn't for us. It's not necessarily a bad thing. You kind of, what's the saying? It's like, it's more about the journey than the destination. I think that's what it came back to a lot of the time.
Yeah, when we finished, though, and I finished and met Tom in Rome, we kind of had a bit of it. There was no time to sink in because we had a mad rush to find a cardboard box to put our bikes in. Because we only had, like, the way we did it is that, to me being the cheapskate, it was a great idea to get cheaper flights out from Genoa in the north of Italy instead of from Rome. So we only had a day to get our boxes together. And I don't know if you've ever been to Rome, but you'll find that there's like 3 bike shops in the whole city, it seems like. And the whole day was spent looking for boxes to put our bikes in. And eventually we found them, though. Another thing about coming to the end of the trip, when we got home and we met our parents in the airport, they looked at us and they're like, oh, why were you so fresh? Like, you look like you've done nothing. Or like, they expected us to be
gaunt, maybe,
tired and skinny and like wrecked. But really, when it's been your life for the past like 2 months, it's the tiredness and the toll of the cycling really doesn't have an effect on you. It's just the way you've been living.
Yeah, like I would say, I think we were both surprised at how well the body adapts to something like that. Telling someone you've done something like this sounds insane, like, especially with being such a long distance. But when you do only do as much as you can per day, your body sort of naturally adapts to it. And towards the end, like, you do maybe 60 Ks and a day, and it wouldn't even be that difficult anymore. It's kind of amazing. As long as you're sleeping well, and I think you're eating and drinking enough, and maybe you don't get too cold and the weather's grand, then it's not as difficult as it would probably sound. The body's pretty incredible in how it sort of adapts to the situations that you put it in. Yeah,
adapting to when we got home as well is quite, I don't know if it was, some things you get used to faster than others, like sleeping in bed at home in the same place every night. And you do find it weird that you go down to the kitchen and there's a load of food in there, not than what you just packed in your panniers. Yeah, so there was some adjustment coming home, but you adjust into it just as quickly as we got into the tour.
I definitely had to adjust my diet. I learned that the hard way, because you get used to eating. Matt, we were just eating crap like entire time. One of our favorites was these things called Prinzenrollen. They're like kind of like a stack of biscuits in plastic packaging. And I gifted Sean a stem bag. So basically, it's just a bag that goes like on the stem of your bike, which is like the thing that attaches the handlebars. And you'd attach it there. And we found out that these biscuits fit perfectly in there, into these bags. So we'd literally just be munching biscuits the whole time and be eating jellies. I think Sean is a big fan of jellies. I'm more of a chocolate person. So it's grand when you're cycling all day and you're kind of burning it off, but you have to adjust. I think I've heard this from a couple of people. You sort of have to adjust yourself a little bit because you'll have the same amount of hunger when you get back, but you won't be cycling as much. So that was probably one of the harder things for me to realize. I was like, what the hell is happening?
Yeah, we got into an awful habit of not stopping for lunch when we were cycling. Yeah, we just keep on cycling and then the day would be gone and we'd just have eaten the bike snacky foods all day. Yeah, you get so comfortable on the bike, just sitting there eating and not stopping and just following the route. It's, yeah, great lifestyle. Yeah.
You sell it very well, actually. Well, listen, guys, thanks for coming in and telling us about your journey from Norway to Italy. It's been a pleasure listening to it, actually. And I've been getting a bit hungry, actually, listening to the last bit of it. Anyone who wants to follow you guys, I believe you have Instagram pages. You'd like to tell us?
Yeah, Instagram and Strava is the best place for me. So it's just Sean_Lundy on Instagram. Yeah.
And mine is Tom Roth_ all small. So yeah, Instagram is kind of the main place that Sean and I would post the pictures and videos from our adventures from the tour. And then since then, we've been up to some other stuff. So yeah, if you do want to have a look, that's probably the best place. And then give us a like or whatever you want. It's up to you. Just if you want to have a look at the pictures.
Perfect. Well, listen, thanks again for coming on the podcast, guys. I really appreciate it.
And thanks very much for having us. You've been a great interviewer and best of luck now with your next guests and stuff. I'm sure there'll be lots more adventures to report on in the future.
Well, thanks very much. Okay, guys. Cheers. And that's it for tonight, listeners. So until next time, get out there and enjoy.
If you want to contact us, then you can do so by emailing us at mountaintoglen@gmail.com or by following Mountain to Glen, the podcast, on Facebook or Twitter. Thank you for listening.